Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The game of softball became a nationwide phenomenon in 1933 when a softball tournament was held at the 1933 Chicago World's Fair. 5 years later, 5 million people were playing in organized leagues across the country. And many of the people who were playing the sport were the Mexican workers who migrated to the Midwest and elsewhere across the U.S. in search of work in the wake of the Mexican Revolution. Fast-pitch softball took hold in many of these Mexican and Mexican-American communities in the post-war period. These communities formed leagues and hosted tournaments that welcomed Mexican-American fast-pitch teams from across the U.S. The story of this generations-long tradition is told in the 2021 book Mexican-American Fast Pitch, Identity at Play in Vernacular Sport. The author, Ben Chappell, is a professor of American Studies at the University of Kansas. Today, we talk to Chappell and with a member of a fast-pitch softball club in San Antonio that's kept the tradition alive for nearly six decades. Ruben Rios Jr. is with the San Antonio Glowworm Athletic Club. If you've never heard of Mexican-American men's fast pitch, you're not alone. Ben Chappell hadn't either, even though he attended college in a city that hosted the longest-running Mexican-American fast pitch tournament, Newton, Kansas.
I heard about it before I knew it was a big deal. I actually studied at Bethel College in Kansas, which is a very small college, and it's a railroad town with a very old Mexican-American community going back 100 years. I knew that there was a softball tournament every summer, but I wasn't around in the summer and I never really went to it. But it was only when I moved to Texas to pursue my graduate work. I was actually in the University of Mariachi when I was at UT Austin. I was studying anthropology and folklore and met the director of the mariachi group. And I have a music background. I play the violin. So he found that out and he invited me to join. And I met a bunch of undergrad students who were playing in the group from South Texas, from the border region. So we were just making introductions. And one student asked me where I was from. I said, well, most recently, I came from Kansas. I went to school in a tiny little town called Newton. A lot of people haven't heard of it. And she said, oh, I know Newton, Kansas. And I said, oh, really? Why is that? She said, my high school mariachi went up and played at the softball tournament there. And I thought, what would possess a high school mariachi group to travel, I don't know what it is, at least 10 hours to play at a softball tournament? I thought that must have been a pretty big deal. And so that caught my notice. And then after that, I also became aware of the fast pitch in Austin, because on the east side of Austin, I would see murals that had not only pictures of people playing ball, but like specific teams and specific players painted on the walls of restaurants and at the Pan American Recreation Center there. And actually, one time I was riding my bike past the park and I saw a fast pitch game going on. That was the Jokers playing in the weekly league. So I kind of came upon it by being involved in Mexican American communities and finding out that fast pitch softball was something that had a long history and that meant a lot to people in certain places. And so when I came to the University of Kansas, boy, it's been 17 years now, I think, knowing that there was this connection between Kansas and Texas and between Mexican-American communities in both places, I decided to find out a little bit more about that. And I started going to tournaments. And yeah, as I say, the rest is history. I spent a number of summers going to the tournaments, learning more and more, meeting more and more people. The Rios family in San Antonio was one of the families that really welcomed me, made me feel at home and took care of me while I was on those trips. That's where it started.
Well, I'm curious, Ruben Rios, we have one of those Rios family members right here. And do you remember hearing how your family may have taken care of Ben while he was in your care?
I knew it was like lodging, just kind of being like a, you know, tour guide. And like Ben said, the connection from Kansas Newton into San Antonio, it, you know, basically pretty much started, you know, in the 60s with my grandpa leaving the service and coming back home. But during that time between now and then, the relationship between Kansas Newton and San Antonio has been grown. They come to our tournament. We go to their tournament, kind of like how it's, you know, a gentleman's handshake. And they were pretty excited when this book did come out. So, you know, all my uncles were pretty excited. It's just one avenue to get the continuation to keep the, you know, the game alive. So, yeah, that was a big thing. Like Ben said, the relationship between Kansas Newton and San Antonio, along with Austin and Houston, it seems like there's a pathway there and there's a connection and to trying to keep this game alive.
Well, Ben, you write about sort of the history of that connection in your book, Mexican American Fast Pitch, and that connection was the railroad. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, sure. I mean, the communities that I've visited where fast pitch is a long tradition, a lot of the railroad has been very important in those communities. And you know, that was the reason that a lot of people settled in areas of Kansas and into Missouri and Nebraska and other parts of the Midwest, because, you know, there's a lot of migration from Mexico to the United States in the period of the Mexican Revolution. And at that time, there was a lot of work in the railroads. And so, you know, labor recruiters would go to places like El Paso, where a lot of people were crossing, and just take a bunch of people to these places where they were building the railroads, and they would establish a home there. You know, Kansas is a pretty spread out state. It's sparsely populated. And so there's a lot of there are small communities and a lot of space between them. And so, you know, people sometimes need a reason to get together. And it turned out that going back to the 1930s and 40s, fast pitch softball was an incredibly popular recreational activity. And it was also entertainment. I mean, that's what people would do to watch their sports. They'd go out and watch the fast pitch game. And so when the Mexican American community got involved in that and started hosting their own tournaments, people got to know each other from different towns and would travel, just like Ruben said. There's always been sort of a reciprocal agreement that, you know, if you come to our tournament, we'll come to yours. And that's how the tradition was really established. The railroad community, I find it to be an interesting way to think about geography, because the fast pitch softball network that I kind of traveled around researching this book, I like to say it goes from Kansas City to Houston, and it goes beyond that too. It goes into Colorado, goes all the way up towards Chicago. But for feasibility's sake, that's what I was looking at. And people were very aware of each other as, you know, communities that were kind of in a similar situation in terms of having been in the United States for a couple of generations. You know, a lot of these are blue collar communities that live together, work together, and they play ball together. Today, the tournaments are really important as reunions for people who have that background. And like in Newton, for example, Newton, Kansas has the longest running tournament that is traditionally Mexican-American. And a lot of people from that community have moved on to live in other cities, to do other jobs, but they come back to that softball tournament like a family reunion. It is a family, you know, people who are not only related, but, you know, they're connected after seeing each other at these events year after year.
Ben Chappell is a professor of American Studies at the University of Kansas. He's the author of Mexican American Fast Pitch, Identity at Play in Vernacular Sport. We're also talking with Ruben Rios Jr. of the San Antonio Glowworm Athletic Club. The Glowworm hosts their 59th annual San Antonio Glowworm Men's Fast Pitch Softball Tournament this weekend in San Antonio. When we come back, the game of Mexican-American fast pitch has evolved over time, but it still has a connection with its community.
There still is leagues going on, and there's still teams that are out there like that are homegrown. They're still playing.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. In the 1940s and 50s, Mexican Americans were living in segregated communities and were fighting stereotypes of being too lazy or not athletically inclined. Fast pitch softball leveled the playing field, so to speak. The sport fostered lifelong bonds between the competing teams and demonstrated to white athletes that Mexican Americans came to play. Fast pitch games and tournaments are family affairs and community get-togethers. Drinks flow, grills flare, and stories about the old days abound. University of Kansas Professor Ben Chappell writes about the tradition in the book Mexican-American Fast Pitch, Identity at Play in Vernacular Sport. We're also joined today by Ruben Rios Jr. of the San Antonio Glowworm Athletic Club, a club founded by his grandfather, Hildebrand Chilolo Rios. Rios explains how his grandfather introduced fast pitch to the city and how the tradition continues to this day, including an international tournament happening in San Antonio this weekend.
You know, he was raised in San Antonio and also in the military, and that's kind of how he started playing baseball. And then, you know, basically in the 20s and 30s, just like Ben said, it was very popular. So as soon as he got out of the service, he started a lounge in 1957. And during that time, he started the Glowworm softball team so they can start coordinating, start participating in these tournaments since it was pretty large at the time. He started that and then basically traveled throughout different cities, Austin and you know, Houston for the summer. And then in 1964, they had their inaugural first year of the Glowworm Tournament, which was July 4th weekend. This is going to be our 59th year continuously. Obviously, we had a break during COVID. He had a love for baseball, and after the military, that's kind of how he came back to, you know, South Texas. Once that started gaining in popularity, it ended up becoming the Glowworm Athletic Club. So everybody was invited, like Ben said, where it's kind of like a reunion, a club. So you didn't necessarily play, but you know what? You had some people out there that, hey, let me cook for y'all for the weekend, go out there and park, stay out of trouble. And then so that started in the 60s, and then it continued in the 70s. You mentioned the Jokers. In Austin, they are going to come to our tournament. They have over the years, and they're going to be one of the 14 teams participating this weekend in the tournament. It's, you know, June 22nd and 23rd. It's over there in Alva Jo Fisher, Lady Bird Park. So we would definitely like anybody who would like to come, open invite to see that relationship. Ben's right. It is a reunion to relive, not necessarily glory days, but they become family. Maybe not by blood, but by the sport. Second, third, fourth generations. When my grandpa and grandma started this softball club. So just the relationships and you know, like I said, it's just not just in Houston and Austin, Kansas and throughout these different places throughout the U.S. And it has evolved almost a global sport. That's kind of where we started from and where we're going. And as we get older, you know, we can't necessarily play on the field, but we can definitely participate and continue that relationship and that community feel.
I just wanted to add a little detail about my experience being welcomed by the Rios family, because there are enough Rios brothers to have their own softball team. And when I first went to tournaments in Texas, one of the first people I met was David Rios. And he and his wife, Yvonne, they basically became my family. And every time I went to a tournament in Texas, I would find where they were sitting. They'd pull up a chair for me. They'd make sure that I was fed and that I was taken care of. And so that family feel is something that was just one of my first experiences. But I also wanted to say that one of the reasons that I did this project, or one of the reasons I do the kind of work that I do, is that I find that if you pay attention to what people love, what they take seriously, what they spend a lot of time doing, you learn all kinds of other things. And so, for example, what I learned, not only in Texas, but throughout the Midwest and in other parts of the country, obviously Mexican Americans have been part of that history for over 100 years. And that's been one of the one of the things that I really want to get across with this book, is that these Mexican-American communities in Kansas connected with Texas have been around for a very long time. The other thing I learned, though, is that baseball has been in Mexico for a very long time. In fact, I think there was professional baseball in Mexico before there was professional soccer. And that is related also to the railroads, because the railroads between Mexico and the United States were integrated into one sort of system. Track workers would come from the United States down into Mexico and play ball, and people kind of picked that up. And so a lot of the people who crossed then into the United States and made a new life for their families in the United States were already ball players, and they brought that along. But then softball in particular is interesting because it's a smaller field, it doesn't take as much land, and it really grew in the playgrounds of the United States and as a kind of a public project. I was doing some archival research in Austin, and I stumbled on some records about how many softball fields were built during the New Deal during Roosevelt's New Deal and the Depression, because softball fields were seen as a way to promote recreation in the community and you know, give people entertainment and exercise and everything else. So it used to be that you could go to a park and check out equipment. You didn't even have to have balls and bats to play. And so I think this is one of the reasons why the sport has become so important, because it was right there embedded in neighborhoods. And so you have places like in Houston, people will talk about Settegast Park, which is right there in the Second Ward Magnolia area. It really was a part of life. A lot of places where I went to fast pitch tournaments, houses were right across the street from the fields, and it was completely integrated into the life of a community. So I just wanted to give a little bit of extra detail on that.
Well, you mentioned in the book, Ben, that as an ethnographer, you're gathering stories, you're talking to players, you're out in the fields, you're talking to the coaches, to the former players, and you point out that this is a collection of stories that they are relating to you. You're not rigorously fact-checking everything that they say. And a lot of it is because a lot of it was not necessarily recorded in newspapers. So can you tell us a little bit about that particular process, knowing that you may not be able to fact-check everything 100%, but really the meat of the story is in the story, not in the nitty-gritty of the details?
Sure. Well, I mean, that's something that is an interesting experience for me, you know, as an academic researcher, because every community I've gone to also has their own historians. And every sport has its own historians. And those people, a lot of times, who are fans of a sport will get really into statistics. You know, softball and baseball are sports that are incredibly documented when somebody's keeping score. You know, they'll keep track of every pitch and every play. And so some people want to know, you know, the details, like who hit 357 versus 356 in this season, or, you know, who really was the best home run hitter? And that's a fun conversation, and people have a lot of fun with those arguments. But as somebody from outside the community and from outside the sport, really, who was coming into it and learning things for the first time, I wasn't going to resolve any of those conversations. But it's okay, because I do think that regardless of which individual might have been the MVP of a particular season, or which one, you know, should be remembered for this or that they accomplished, all of those players and all of those stories come together to form something that's valued by the whole community. And so my question was not so much who's got the right information here. It was more like, why is it so important that we get together and remember these things? Why does it mean so much to the community to have these conversations and even have these arguments about, you know, my granddad was better than yours? And it's because people are invested in it, and because it meant so much to people to come together as a community and have that time together, and also to be good at it. Because, you know, the history of Mexican America and the experiences that people have had in this country have often been experiences of being underappreciated, underestimated. And I definitely had people tell me stories about how there were some great high school athletes that played in the fast pitch scene, but there are also people who never got to play high school sports because the coach looked at them and assumed that they either didn't want to win, or they didn't have the discipline to work hard for it, or whatever. They made these assumptions that kept people from opportunities. And so community-based fast pitch was one of the ways that people made their own opportunities. And there were people in this tradition whose their attitude was basically, okay, if my high school doesn't want me, I'm going to go play for my family, or I'm going to go play for my community. And they did great. And they actually showed what they were capable of. And so, you know, these are the kinds of things that are interesting to me, because it's telling a whole story of the community. It's not even just about which specific team was best, although that's also fun.
And so, Ruben, you know, we're talking about stories. Has there been, like, any legends around the San Antonio glowworm? And I'm talking about maybe, like, that one game that everybody still talks about years later, or that one pitch or that one hit. Is there one that still circulates around the family, maybe?
There's numerous ones, but especially for our tournament back in the 90s, where it was predominantly a homegrown team against a big budget team, where it would bring players in from all over just to have this prestigious tournament. And I remember in 92 that did happen, and it was a championship game. and they went to extra innings. It was a total of 9 innings, and I still remember it to this day. It was a local San Antonio team against, and this team had players from all over the U.S., and it was a lot of them that, like Ben talked about, not just high school. These were ones that couldn't make the baseball. They were in the, let's just say, the single or double A or even triple A, and it was like they were part of the, let's just say, the Chicago Cubs organization. They knew that they were never going to get to the show, quote-unquote, so they just kind of gave up on that dream, and to continue to be a prime athlete, well, let me go ahead and let me be a part of this superpower team. So I remember that, and we still talk about it to this day. And actually, the local San Antonio team ended up winning on a controversy, third base, obviously, but it was really intense, and I still remember to that day. People still talk about that, where it was kind of like David against Goliath. And there, even to this day, there's a divide, you know, with the local homegrown talent as compared to, you know, we call imports. So it kind of gave, you know, a little sense of, hey, we can still do it. We can still compete against, quote unquote, corporate America or the super team, the Yankees, you know, stuff like that. But I also wanted to maybe circle back. I know Ben had alluded to in Austin at Pan American, they're still having city league games during the week there at Pan American, which I believe it's on the east side of Austin. So the city of Austin has done a great job putting new lights. In this recent years, they have done a marvelous job of restoring that back to the way it is. So even to this day, after all these years, there is still a city league in Austin. There still is leagues going on, and there's still teams that are out there like that, that are homegrown. They're still playing to this day. So it's just stuff like that. And then, of course, you'll have the big superpower teams that bring in all these players from outside. But we still have common ground. It's still, you know, fast pitch. You know, what's really helping out to see my daughter and to see different people, to see the Mexican-American just in the College World Series they recently just passed, to see, you know, that type, that vision, where, you know what, that goes a long way too, that with the evolution of now college sports, the women's game, to see, you know, a Mexican-American starting and playing and winning a game, that to me, that's going to go for generations and say, okay, that's going to help out. That's, you're breaking the foundation to actually see somebody live on TV that can compete with anybody and everybody. I think that's a big break. But overall, Mexican-American, just fast pitch and just general, just to see that, to see somebody like you that, hey, look, in 5 or 10 years, I can do that. I think that's the biggest thing, too, where now it's an even playing field, or now there's not really excuses. Like, okay, we have to evolve, we have to change, but yet still have the tradition, still have the community, and to let you know, okay, these are your dreams and aspirations. We will support you in what we can in any endeavor. And I think that's a big thing with Mexican-American fast pitch.
And Ben, you talk about a little bit the evolution of how Mexican-American fast pitch has grown throughout the years. You talk about how many teams have opened their tournaments to people who are not of Mexican-American descent. And you also have a chapter about, you know, women in the game, just like how Ruben was alluding to. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that the way that sports are gendered is, you know, important piece of this reality, and it's interesting and problematic in a lot of ways, because it's like, what I didn't realize before I started doing this research was, you know, there were women who played baseball really well even before the sort of league of their own story, and they started to get banned from baseball when they started winning. But as far as men's and women's fast pitch softball goes, the fact that you have men playing fast pitch is something that a lot of people identify with an earlier era. I think when Ruben talks about the traditional aspect of it, it's kind of rare nowadays to see men playing fast pitch. It has become much more widely played by women, and that's totally related to bringing women and young girls into sports, and especially around the with Title IX, the efforts to make opportunities equal on a non-discriminatory basis. Girls were first encouraged to play softball because somebody thought it would be easier or less strenuous than baseball. And anybody who plays fast pitch will argue that that's not the case. Fast pitch is its own game. Softball is its own game that has its own challenges, and it's an incredibly rigorous and incredibly competitive sport. And the women who play softball have really shown that in the heyday of what we call the commercial leagues. Like back in the 30s, women's softball drew 30, 40,000 people to some games in Southern California. What I've learned about it is that because fast pitch has been really preserved in Mexican-American communities, it's become kind of like a community resource. People who grow up in it have a knowledge of the game, and they know about strategy, they know about tactics, they learn about different pitches. And all of that knowledge and that background is something that people have really been able to draw on in order to get new opportunities. Opportunity becomes a factor because with the growth of women's softball, and especially when Title IX was passed that said that universities had to offer equal opportunities to participate in sports, women's softball became a scholarship sport. And so if you were good at that game, that's something that you could turn into an opportunity to get an education and to maybe improve your employment opportunities going forward. I have spoken to a number of women who grew up in communities that had a softball tradition. And a lot of times they might say, well, I learned pitch from my grandpa, or my grandpa introduced me to people who knew how to pitch, who knew about base running and knew the tactics of softball, knew how to slap the ball as a hitter or whatever. That opportunity to sort of draw on a community tradition and turn that into an opportunity to maybe get a scholarship, go Division I, Division II, and get their education is kind of a real material effect of this tradition being kept alive. I know that there are women softball players who come right out of the Glowworm tradition or are based in Houston or in Austin or some of these other places, Kansas City and Newton on this side too. And that's the story they tell, that because their community was committed to keeping softball going throughout the years, they were able to use that resource for themselves and get into that collegiate softball world.
Ruben shared one of his stories about sort of the legendary stories of the game. You talked to so many people. What was one of your favorite stories that you heard in talking to the people in your book?
There's so many. It's really, really hard. But I'll say one of my favorite stories was kind of a situation like what Ruben was saying, where there was, you know, sometimes in the heyday of softball, getting into the 50s and 60s, there would be teams that would spend a bunch of money to get people together and become these powerhouse teams that just won everything. And the Jokers in Austin, some of those folks who tell me stories about Louis Murillo was the man who kind of got the Jokers started on the east side of Austin. And he was a very diminutive person. I think he was about 5 feet tall. And he knew the game, and he coached, and he knew the tactics. They tell me one story when they had this powerhouse team come to town, and it was when the Jokers were starting to play outside the neighborhood and try to make a name for themselves. And I can't remember if it was because their pitching staff had all gotten hurt, or they were one by one, they were sort of going through their pitchers, and finally they didn't have anybody to pitch against these power hitters. And Louis said, I'm going to go out there on the mound. So this little guy got out there on the mound and started throwing what they call junk. He just started throwing all kinds of technical pitches, making the ball move all over the place. And they actually won the game against this team that looked like they were much more athletic, you know, much more overpowered. But, you know, a lot of that is people who grew up together, know how to play together. You know, I can only imagine what that game must have looked like, what it must have been like to watch people, you know, from the same community, and they won the game. And so, you know, that's just one example. And I'm not even telling it with a lot of specificity. It's a pretty vague example, but there are so many stories like that. I wasn't there to sort of adjudicate which ones were the most true, but it sure was fun to sit around and listen to people tell those stories and to join in that experience of remembering all the time that they had together as a fast pitch family.
Do you have any final words, Ruben, before we wrap things up?
If you're definitely in the San Antonio area this weekend, to come out to Alva Jo Fisher on Nacogdoches Saturday or Sunday to see these teams compete and try to win a qualifier for the ISC, which is going to be in Canada in 2 or 3 months. Yeah, definitely come out and share stories, and we're always welcoming. We always have a tent out there in the parking lot or in the grass, and definitely open invites to anybody that's there. Get some, you know, a little bit of food and some memories and watch some entertainment, and it's going to be a little hot, so definitely we'll definitely have plenty of water for everybody. So, no, thank you for your time and support.
Like Ruben said, I would just encourage people to, you know, to seek these events out, because, you know, if you live in one of the cities that we've mentioned, likelihood is that there are events like fast pitch tournaments that happen from year to year. And it is so rewarding to go and be a guest at one of these places, see some great sports, eat some great food, meet some great people. It's just really rewarding to find out what's going on in your own neighborhood and what's been going on for a long time.
Ben Chappell is professor of American Studies at the University of Kansas and author of Mexican-American Fast Pitch, Identity at Play in Vernacular Sport. The book was the recent winner of the 2023 Byron Caldwell Smith Book Award for Nonfiction, an award presented to outstanding writers who live or work in Kansas. We're also talking with Ruben Rios Jr. of the San Antonio Glowworm Athletic Club. The 59th annual San Antonio Glowworm Tournament happens this weekend in San Antonio. The winner of this International Softball Congress qualifier takes a step to compete in the ISC World Tournament in August in British Columbia. The Glowworm Tournament includes over a dozen teams from 10 countries, including Mexico, Guatemala, Japan, and the Czech Republic. It takes place June 22nd and 23rd at the Alva Joe Fisher Softball Complex at San Antonio's Lady Bird Johnson Park. If you can't make it in person, view the tournament on YouTube. We'll have a link for you at tpr.org. Thanks for joining us today for Fronteras. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Marian Navarro. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Hear past episodes at tpr.org and on the Fronteras podcast. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.